Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. For some, it starts with that first puff as a teenager, that extra glass of wine after work, the legally prescribed opioid to treat pain from an injury. But a simple pleasure or a reliable pain treatment can kick start cravings that turn into a dependence that can hijack the brain. Scientists are studying how addiction changes the brain, and that's helping in treating the condition. Author and National Geographic writer Fran Smith recently wrote about the issue. We'll post a link to her article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Fran Smith joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You write that 30 years ago, the model for treating addiction was much different. How has that changed? How does addiction change the brain? What do we know?
Well, the whole idea of addiction used to be that it was about physical dependence and nasty withdrawal if you stopped. And the sense of addiction now is it's a much broader definition of addiction. So the scientific community really understands addiction to be any behavior that's just a repetitive, compulsive pursuit of an activity or a substance despite life-damaging consequences and despite no pleasure. When people are addicted, they stop getting pleasure from the high. You mentioned that first puff of cigarette, mm-hmm. but when it's an addiction, people stop getting pleasure, and it's really more to relieve the misery.
And you said activity or substance, activity being something like gambling, right?
Exactly. For the first time, the psychiatric establishment several years ago recognized a behavior, gambling, as an addiction, in many ways, just exactly like an addiction to drugs or alcohol.
So does addiction, is it affected in the same place in the brain if it is gambling versus drugs or alcohol? I remember,
yeah,
I was really addicted to cigarettes, but I'd never gotten a thing from gambling. So what's the difference?
Well, it's a really good question, and there's a lot of complexity. The brain is an incredible organ and very complex, and every chemical, every activity affects the brain in very specific ways, but in the general way, they all do the same thing, which is that they cause these release the spike of dopamine, the chemical dopamine, which is we used to think of dopamine as a chemical of pleasure, but now scientists understand it much more as a chemical of desire and motivation. So gambling, cigarettes, all of those things, alcohol, cocaine, cause these spikes in dopamine and then a drop, so these surges, and that chemical reaction really causes a whole cascade of changes in the brain.
And what does that look like? I know it's brain imaging that has enabled scientists to study this more thoroughly. What exactly changes in the brain?
Well, lots of things changes. The structure of the brain changes, structural parts change, the chemistry, the balance of chemicals change, the cell-to-cell signaling, which is really kind of how we learn, changes, and the sum total of all these changes is to cause the brain to really narrow the field of attention, almost like a zoom lens on a camera, so that it focuses on this one thing and diminishes the importance of other really valuable things in life, friends, family, career, and at the same time, the changes in the frontal part of the region, which is the part of the brain that's responsible for making good decisions, assessing risk, those parts are compromised. So you get this kind of notch up in this, focus on the thing, and the ability to put the brakes on that desire is diminished.
We're talking about addiction. My guest is Fran Smith. She's a National Geographic writer and Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter based in New York. If you have a question or comment about addiction, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Can you give us a sense of how big the problem of addiction is in the United States? We talk, of course, Ohio is a ground zero for the opioid crisis, but we also know that there's huge upticks again in methamphetamines and cocaine overdoses.
Right. I'm really glad you mentioned that, because all those other addictions haven't gone away as the opioid crisis has really increased. So, it's important for for the opioid situation to really be a window into the magnitude of addiction across substances. The Surgeon General says that there are 21 million Americans who have a drug or an alcohol addiction, so that doesn't even count the behavioral addictions mm-hmm. we talked about earlier. And the disorder is actually more common than cancer. It costs hundreds of billions of dollars a year. There are more than 100,000 deaths are attributed to addiction every year. So, you know, it's huge.
You know, I can understand that somebody starts, you know, just a friendly poker game with some buddies when they're in high school. You know, I can that doesn't seem like it's something that would be addictive. But why do people do things like heroin that everybody knows is highly addictive, particularly the new forms that are out? Why do they do stuff like that? Why do they do stuff that they know will harm themselves?
Well, that was really one of the questions that I wanted to answer going into this. And you know, everybody reacts differently to different substances, and there are people, you know, many people, you know, use any of these drugs and don't become addicted. So people start off for pleasure. You know, you mentioned at the top of the show, a lot of the opioid problem now and even the heroin problem starts with a prescription opioid drug.
Right.
So people start for all kinds of reasons. Different people are, their brains are more vulnerable. Now, scientists don't understand a lot about what causes that vulnerability, but, you know, trauma, stress, situation in life, we know that the adolescent brain is especially vulnerable, and many people who have addiction of all sorts really started as teenagers or young adults. Nobody sets out, as you said, to become addicted, and you know, but once those changes happen, it's really, really hard to quit. And you know, if you're not in that situation, it's hard to understand why people can persist, even when it's ruining their lives. But it's much more complex than just willing it to stop, to go away.
In your article, you talk about Dr. Luigi Galimberti and his use of TMS, or transcranial magnetic stimulation. What has he discovered?
Well, this was really an interesting story to me. So that brain stimulation technique has actually been around for a while, and it's used in cases of migraine. It's used to treat depression, FDA approved. And so Dr. Galimberti, and he's in Italy, but a number of researchers in the United States as well are experimenting with it for addiction. And it uses electrical pulses to heal neural pathways in the brain that are believed to have been compromised by addiction. So the idea is either, depending on where you focus the current, either you tamp down the desire, so you tamp down the circuits that are associated with craving, or you really boost the brain circuits that are associated with control and judgment.
How does this work with something like food? Because there are food addictions as well, right?
Right. Well, food addiction is still a controversial area.
Yeah.
Most people that I talk to, that's just people who like to eat, sort of feel that they have certain food addictions. Very hard to control. And there's been, you know, really good research with animals showing that, you know, if you give rats sugar and high-fat, highly processed foods, they really kind of react in the same way as rats do when you get them hooked on cocaine. So there's really something chemical going on.
Well, this rat would agree with the sugar addiction. You want another handful of candy corn.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I think that the whole, you know, we've been talking about this for about 10 years now, the brain plasticity.
Mm-hmm.
How does that come into play in all of this? Is this part of that rewiring you're talking about?
Exactly. So that's the, you know, the thing that is so marvelous about our brains is that it is plastic, which means that it responds, it's constantly changing in response to our environment. And, you know, that's how we learn. That's how we take in information. That's how we adapt to our world. And what's so insidious about addiction is that it you know, hijacks, to use that word again, but those exact same mechanisms that make us, you know, such adaptable creatures, and it hijacks those systems and kind of turns them in on itself and turns it into a really devastating thing for people.
Is the tipping point different for different people too?
Yes. I mean, you know, as I said earlier, you know, lots and lots of people use any of these substances and don't become addicted. It's only really a small percentage of people who become addicted. And, you know, nobody can, there's no test to see if you're that person that's going to become addicted and if you're that person that's going to become addicted to opioid or to cocaine or to cigarettes or alcohol or whatever it is. So, you know, for different people, in interviewing for this article, I talked with a woman, a young woman, 33 years old, who's battled addiction since she's 16. And she said the very first time she shot heroin, she was addicted. Wow. And I've talked with other people who said that, you know, that didn't, you know, that for a long time it was kind of a recreational, fun kind of thing they did. And then something happened, you know, they did it more, maybe in response to stress, maybe because it was around a lot, and then they got hooked.
Mike in Columbus, you're on the air with Fran Smith of National Geographic. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I'm interested in the question of cross-addiction. Is a person who is strongly addicted to, say, nicotine, more likely to become addicted to alcohol or painkillers or whatever? And related to that, we know that once a person is addicted, they're always addicted. They may learn to manage that and avoid that substance, but the addiction is still there. Would that not imply that a mother who, say, smokes when she's pregnant is going to have a child who is already addicted at birth, even if he or she isn't subjected to tobacco again till maybe the age of 14 or 15, and that there would be a tendency toward those other drugs.
Yeah. That, you know, we've heard about crack babies, alcohol-dependent babies, that kind of a thing. Fran Smith?
Yeah, well, there are a couple of questions in there, so let me just answer them both. So very quickly, most people who are identify as cocaine addicts or people, you know, addicted to heroin or any substance, most people have more than one addiction, and you know, and often that smoking is associated with all kinds of addictions. So it's actually fairly uncommon to have somebody who's addicted only to one substance, only to one drug. On the question of babies, we in the National Geographic story, we write about babies who were born dependent on opioids. And there's a lot of really, you know, a lot of really good work now on how to wean those babies and the best techniques for weaning them and really being able to send them home from the hospital, you know, in fairly good shape. We don't, you know, really know yet what the long-term effects of that is going to be. Some of the research from crack babies years ago shows that if these children have really good services, good support, you know, good upbringing, good education, they really do a lot better than everybody worried about at the time that this crisis was happening. But, you know, there are a lot of babies now born dependent on opioids, and so it's going to be really important to follow them and make sure those kids get the supports they need and see what happens long term.
Mike, thanks a lot for that call. A lot of this really boils down to awareness in the end. I mean, you know, opioids are still necessary for people who are dealing with chronic pain. There are other ways to do it, too, but some people, that's the best way. I have a friend who's addicted to alcohol, and she avoids opioids for treating pain after surgeries because she's worried of that cross-addiction issue. But isn't it really a matter of just being hyper-aware when you're going to do anything?
Well, awareness is certainly important, and so is destigmatization. You know, it's really hard for people to seek treatment. There are good treatments out there for people. There are medications that are really, really useful for certain addictions, and especially for opioid addiction, that, you know, significantly cut the death rate from overdoses and help people, you know, reduce their craving. And not nearly as many people have access to that as could benefit. And, you know, one of the reasons is the stigma.
Fran Smith, thanks for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks. It's been great talking with you.
Fran Smith is a National Geographic writer and Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter based in New York. We'll have a link to her article about addiction on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. For diabetics, the process of checking blood sugar levels with a quick prick to the finger is a daily routine. New technologies for type 1 and type 2 diabetes could end that routine, or the need for it, I should say. Joining us is registered dietitian, nutritionist, and director of diabetes education at the Central Ohio Diabetes Association, Brenda Rendelman. Welcome back, Brenda.
Ann, thank you so much. It's really nice to be here.
There is a newly FDA-approved diabetes device that doesn't require someone to do that blood prick to the finger kind of a thing. Tell us about it.
Right. It's called the Libre Flash, and it's basically a little patch one puts on the arm, and it has a little catheter in it, and the catheter goes, you know, into the skin, and it can be worn for 10 days. And what's wonderful, Ann, is a person simply waves the sensor over the patch and it reads their blood glucose. Think of what this does for someone who, you know, many of us might be averse to pricking our fingers several times a day or at least once or twice a day. Mm-hmm. They no longer have to do that. They wear this patch that has a little catheter under the skin. And then to check their blood sugar, they simply wave the device over the patch. And there's the blood glucose reading. It's amazing.
How long has the finger prick test been around?
Oh, and for a long, 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 years and years and years and years.
Decades?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm trying to think. Oh, my gosh. Yes, certainly decades, and I'm not sure how many decades, but several decades. Now, having said that, the meters have gotten much, much better, and they're wonderful in that many of them are very small, and they only require very, very small drops of blood. So I don't want to make it sound like, you know, having to prick one's finger to test blood is a terrible thing. It's just that there are some people, you know, there's just simply a certain percent of people who definitely would rather not. And it doesn't matter who it is.
The patch,
yeah,
the Libre patch, who puts that on you?
Well, the person can actually
do it themselves.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Is it more expensive?
I don't, but it's a new product. It's a new product, and I mean there is a cost to it, and I forget the actual cost, but you know, diabetes is an expensive disease.
Right.
I want to say it might come out to around $5 a day, but I don't want to be specific.
And what about the finger prick test?
Well, the problem with the finger prick test is the strips. The lancets, of course, are what one uses to prick the finger. Mm-hmm. It's the strips that can be very expensive.
And those are the things that indicate the blood glucose level.
Yeah, yeah. One touches the strip to the little drop of blood and
it's like a litmus test type of thing, right?
Yeah. And then one inserts the strip into their little meter, or into the meter, and that gives the reading of the blood sugar. But the cost of the strips can really be a barrier for some people. Now, there's a wide array of excellent meters. I mean, there's tons of meters. I think there's around 80 meters on the market.
Uh-huh.
And actually, most are very accurate. So there are lots of options, but the strips are still pricey. And
how much do they cost?
Well, there's some strips that can cost up to $1 a day, or $1 a strip, rather.
Okay, and if you have to do it 2 or 3 times a day.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But one can get them for less also, mm-hmm. where they're less than half that. So it depends. You know, there's certain businesses, large retail businesses, that sell their own meter and strips, and that sometimes decreases the price.
I guess ultimately what we're talking about is just more choices for people.
There are tons of choices. That's, you know, no one would ever want the diagnosis of diabetes, Anne, but I've got to say that this is a time when there is an incredible array of therapies, treatments, technological devices, like we just spoke of the Libre Flash. I mean, it's really an amazing time. It still remains that education is key, so that the person is empowered and has the information and everything they need to make it all pull together. But yeah, it's like,
we're talking about new devices to help people who have diabetes. If my guest right now is Brenda Rendelman. She's director of the Diabetes Education of Diabetes Education at the Central Ohio Diabetes Association. If you have a question or comment about diabetes for Brenda, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. What is diabetes for people who may not be? We hear it. It's sort of like an everyday term, but maybe some people don't understand what it is.
Right. Yeah, it's a rather complex disease. Of course, there's type 1, which affects only about 5% of those who are diagnosed with diabetes. In type 1, there's an absolute loss of insulin production. All right.
So it doesn't matter how much you weigh. It doesn't matter what your diet is.
Right, exactly. Okay. That's really an autoimmune disorder. It certainly involves blood sugar and the lack of insulin, but that's what type 1 is. And so a person who's been diagnosed with type 1 has to receive insulin the rest of their life, every day of their life, with every meal, and also receive, of course, a background dose of insulin.
So what's the connection between a meal and blood glucose levels?
Well, and, you know, when we consume food, we need to get the energy from that food. That's primarily why we are designed to eat food.
Well, except for me and my candy corn.
Oh, I'm right with you, Anne, and Halloween's coming up. I'm counting the days. So we derive the energy we need, our cells need, from the food we take in. That energy then needs to get into the cells. And insulin is basically, you can think of it as the key that unlocks the cells, that allows the energy to get into the cells. Now,
if you don't have insulin, what happens to the energy? What's the consequences?
Well, the problem is, Ian, if we don't have the insulin we need?
Yeah.
Yeah, if we don't have the insulin we need, and insulin is essential, the blood sugar continues to build up and build up and build up in the bloodstream, and that can be very damaging.
To what?
To our eyes, to our kidneys, to our nerves. So we think of things, and to our cardiovascular system. So that's where those phrases of retinopathy, which is eye disease, nephropathy, kidney disease, neuropathy, disease of the nerves, and we often think of that in the toes and feet, heart attack and stroke. All those are complications of unmanaged blood sugar. But there's good news. None of that has to happen, because there are treatments, therapy, and there's the education and support out there to make sure people are empowered to make choices so that they can manage their diabetes well. And let me just mention that with type 2 diabetes, a person is still, for usually a very long time, still producing insulin. There might ultimately be a loss of insulin production in that person with type 2. But in type 2, there's insulin resistance. And basically that means that the cells are not welcoming, if you will, or willing to allow all the sugar into them.
So it's so the other side of the equation is affected.
It kind of is. And so the person with type 2 diabetes, and again, that type 2, that kind of diabetes is really what affects about 95% of those who are diagnosed with diabetes. But in type 2, the person is still producing insulin, might actually be producing quite a bit of insulin, but the fact is, it's not working as it should. And type 2 almost always has the component of insulin resistance. And again, it's like, you know, if we were to go to our car and try to unlock it and the key had a piece broken off, it wouldn't work right? Wouldn't open the door? That's the same thing with
insulin. But in type 2, you can get the key fixed. You can get it fixed. You can actually... Some people can
the good news, you've got it. The insulin resistance can be improved, definitely. And glucose uptake, that is pulling the blood sugar from the bloodstream and getting it into the cells where it's needed, can be improved. And we go back to the basics, and you've probably already guessed the things that improve insulin resistance are physical activity within one's ability, all right? So, you know, if there are mobility issues or joint pain, whatever, they might do chair exercises and healthy eating.
Why does weight is so often associated with type 2 diabetes?
Right. Not all. But most people, but definitely not all people, but most people with type 2 who are diagnosed with type 2 are carrying extra weight. The fact is that extra body weight does increase insulin resistance. And there's it's kind of a, you know, complex thing, but it worsens insulin resistance. The good news is that as this study showed, NIDTK's study many years ago showed, and which was really the launch of the DPP program, that weight loss, a fairly small amount.
Quickly.
5 to 7% of weight loss. So we're talking, 14 pounds if a person's carrying 200 pounds, and that's, you know, maybe too much for that person.
Some people can be very overweight, though, and not have type 2 diabetes.
You got it.
So it's a propensity that you already have, and the weight gain just aggravates that.
It can be,
or exacerbates it.
It can be such an inexplicable disease. And I mean, I've known I worked with a woman whose 7 daughters all developed type 2. The woman had type 2.
Uh-huh.
And you know, she was a mature lady, maybe in her 70s or so. All of her she had 7 daughters, no sons. All of her daughters developed type 2 in their 40s. Now, there's an example. We can't deny the genetic impact.
Yeah.
I have known several people, though, there was no genetic history. There was, nothing. And I've certainly known individuals who, looking at them, one wouldn't really think that they needed to lose much, if any, weight at all.
Yeah.
There's that, there are just various factors. Yes.
The Central Ohio Diabetes Association is hosting a free class on the power and practice of mindful eating.
Yes.
That's tonight. And for more information, listeners, go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Mm-hmm. What is this just for people who are diabetic, or maybe you hear about that phrase pre-diabetic?
Right. Tonight's discussion, and it'll be led by a wonderful, excellent dietitian named Julie Palmer, 6 p.m. at our agency on Denison. It's really appropriate for anyone who has diabetes, pre-diabetes, or wants to avoid becoming diabetic. Maybe the person is carrying extra weight and really wants to work on that issue. And, you know, a key thing, frankly, in decreasing our risk factors is bringing down our weight, whether there's a family history or not. Pre-diabetes, you touched on pre-diabetes. Pre-diabetes, of course, we know that millions and millions of people in our country have prediabetes and don't know it. Well, specifically, it's blood sugar levels above normal.
Okay.
but not within the diagnostic range for diabetes.
Okay.
So, you know, and a fasting blood sugar level that is normal would be below 100. So up to 99 is considered a normal fasting blood sugar. 100 to 125, if one has a fasting blood sugar level in that range, and that should be confirmed by a second test, that's a pre-diabetes range. And then 126 or above of a fasting blood sugar, again, it needs to be confirmed a second time, that indicates diabetes.
You know, getting back to my candy corn issue.
Yeah.
it's not just stuff like that.
Right.
It's carbs,
things
like bread and
right.
pasta, too.
Right.
It's all about the sugar. It's not about...
Yeah. Yeah. Really, the most important thing is that total carbohydrate amount. The total carbohydrate that we consume at a meal has the most impact on our blood sugar. Carbohydrate is the macronutrient. As you know, it's one of the three macronutrients. There's carbohydrate, protein, and fat. Carbohydrate has the most impact on blood sugar.
Huh.
And things like pasta, and, you know, raise your hand. I've got my hand up.
Just keep my hand up the whole
exactly,
time.
Exactly. Rice. Okay. my hand's up. Yeah. Bread. Okay. There. Potatoes, sweet potatoes. You got
it. We all like it.
Yep. Love them. Those are what we consider, are some of those things that we consider carbohydrate dense. And the fact is, sweet potatoes, that's a wonderful food.
It's a superfood.
It's a superfood, and it's full of vitamin A. It's a great thing. You know, brown rice, full of energy. It's a wonderful food. However, it's like a lot of things. Too much of a good thing, Ann, it's too much.
So we're talking about portion control,
portion
too.
Control. In one cup, if you think of rice, Ann, cooked rice, one cup, imagine one level cup. You know, yeah, that's a nice serving, but it's not unheard of, at least for me, to eat that much with, say, an Asian meal, you know.
Where they give you a pound.
Exactly. They might get you. You might get two
Literally.
Cups. You might get two cups. And if you eat two cups of white rice, that is six servings of carbohydrate. We really don't recommend anymore for women in general. A good rule of thumb, and again, this is dependent on height and, you know, age and activity level, but for many women, you know, perhaps for like you and I, no more than about three servings of carbohydrate at any meal would be a good level. So, and that's about 45 grams. Now we want to round that out with lean protein and healthy fats. You know, fats get a bad rap. They really do. But healthy fats are wonderful for us. So whether it's, you know, the fat in an avocado or the fat in salmon or olive oil, canola oil, soybean oil, those are all wonderful. So don't be afraid of fats, but respect the amount of fat, because in a teaspoon, there's 45 calories.
So again, it's all about portion control.
Exactly.
You can learn all about this tonight. Central Ohio Diabetes Association is hosting a free class on the power and practice of mindful eating. For more information, check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Brenda Rendelman, thanks so much for joining us again. I appreciate your time.
And thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Brenda Rendelman is the Director of Diabetes Education at the Central Ohio Diabetes Association. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Parents of kids who play contact sports probably have heard by now about the danger of concussions to young developing brains. In recent years, concussions and repeated blows to the head have been shown to be more closely linked with mental disorders and even disease later in life than has been previously known. Now, a new large-scale study has another reason, gives us another reason to protect young people from head trauma. Concussions may increase the risk of later developing multiple sclerosis. New York Times Well-Blog columnist Gretchen Reynolds recently wrote about that. She joins us by phone. Gretchen, welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
Is this a correlation study or a causation study?
It is a correlation study, and that's the first thing I would say is this study did not prove that if your child gets a concussion, they're going to develop any kind of problem, including multiple sclerosis. But it did find a surprisingly strong correlation.
How surprisingly strong? How strong?
Well, this was a study. First of all, it was done in Sweden. So these kids, this is something to bear in mind. None of these kids were playing football,
right,
as we think of football. They were playing other kinds of sports. So when these kids got concussions, it was probably in soccer, skiing, falling, anything.
Uh-huh.
And so what they did was the Swedes have a lot of databases about the health of Swedes. And one of them they used to find everyone in Sweden who had developed multiple sclerosis since it started to be a reportable disease, which was in the 1960s. And it proved to be about 8,000 people. And then they linked them, or they matched them to 10 Swedish citizens who were the same age, lived in the same area, had the same education, and who had not developed multiple sclerosis. And then they went back to another database and looked to see whether any of these now 80,000 people had had concussions or broken bones when they were young. And broken bones were important because it might have been that even at a young age that children had certain symptoms of multiple sclerosis. Mm. And so they were more likely to fall. And if so, they would also have had broken bones. And what they found was that if an adolescent, they looked at two age groups. They looked at children under the age of 11 and children who were 11 to 20, adolescents.
Mm-hmm.
And they found that if an adolescent had had one concussion during the adolescent teenage years, they had almost a 25%, or I think it was 23%, increased risk of developing multiple sclerosis in adulthood. And if they'd had multiple concussions, the risk was closer to 150%, which is a really significant concern.
It is. First, before we move on, tell us what multiple sclerosis is.
Multiple sclerosis is an autoimmune disease of the nervous system. And in multiple sclerosis, no one really knows what causes it, but parts of the immune system start attacking the outer layer of nerve fibers and can lead to scarring. You start having all sorts of issues with muscle control and other issues.
And does it usually affect people at a certain age?
It's usually in relatively young people under the age of 40.
Okay.
And it often can start occurring, or you start seeing symptoms even in people who were in their 20s or 30s. And so what seems to have been occurring in this case, and again, this was observational. There's no absolute proof that
right.
one thing led to the other, although the authors did do a pretty good job of trying to control for lots of factors. And what they suspect, and they have seen this in animal models where they have essentially given animals concussions, and they have seen the development of some of the early symptoms of multiple sclerosis. And the scientists were worried that something about the trauma may ignite a whole cascade of physiological problems that may also require some genetic underpinning, because not every child who had a concussion as a teenager went on to develop multiple sclerosis, but the majority did not. But in some, it looks like there may have been a reaction caused by the head trauma that could have contributed to the multiple sclerosis. And to me, that's enough to say that's one more reason to not let kids have concussions.
Repeated concussions have been linked to chronic traumatic encephalopathy, CTE. That's a degenerative brain disease that affects the ability to think, and many other things. Multiple sclerosis is also a disease that affects the central nervous system. Is there any connection between those two?
Probably, but it's very, very difficult to study that because especially with chronic traumatic encephalopathy, they find it only after someone is dead. They can only confirm it during an autopsy. You can't do the kind of studies on living people's brains and nervous systems to let us know what is really going on inside when someone has this kind of head trauma, and particularly when young people do, and when the brain is still, to some degree, developing.
Did you tell me that a similar study's been done for adults as far as comparing the data?
There have been, yes. They've been smaller. This was actually a very, very large study.
Yeah.
In terms of this. There have been studies suggesting that concussions in adults might also contribute. And again, all of this is linkages, not causation.
Right.
But there does seem to be a link between head trauma in adults and an onset of multiple sclerosis. So the lesson, I think, and this may seem obvious, but it can't be said enough, is we need to do all that we can as parents and also as adults to avoid having unnecessary head trauma. And a lot of concussions that occur in youth sports really could be avoided.
Did it show any difference in genders?
No, there was no difference in genders.
Okay.
With that being said, there were more girls in the group of the almost 8,000 who had concussions, because girls often are at higher risk of concussions in sports than boys.
In general,
In general, yes. And multiple sclerosis is more common in females than males. So that just numerically, there were more women in this particular study, but there did not seem to be a greater incidence or a greater risk numerically by gender.
Okay. So has this inspired any other studies out there that you know of? Is this notable?
I think there are going to be a lot of studies. Obviously, this is a big concern. We want our children, we want our young children, we want our teenagers to be physically active. It's very important for their long-term health. It's very important for avoiding weight gain. It's very important for academic performance.
Mm-hmm.
But we also really do have to ensure that if we are promoting this kind of activity, that it's as safe as it can be. And a lot of that begins with making sure that kids follow the rules, making sure that the refs call fouls, making sure that if someone is hurt, that they are taken out,
mm-hmm.
making sure they're evaluated and don't go back in.
Well, I was going to say, did they drill down to see if there was any differences between subjects who had been treated for the concussion and who had followed all the rules versus those who hadn't?
Well, no. You know, it's very difficult to do that. This was a retrospective study.
Gotcha.
They were looking back at people. And these were also children who had gone to the hospital for concussion.
Yeah.
So it does not include the many, many children who probably did not.
Right.
And it is important, if you are a parent, if you are someone involved in youth sports and you see a game practice and there's even a whisper of a suspicion of a head injury, that child should be removed and evaluated. And that is a legal requirement in almost every state now,
right?
But it is not always followed. And there was an interesting other study that came out just last week that showed that when those kind of laws are instituted in states, and if they are followed, the incidence of concussions does go down. So if we, as parents and officials, are very vigilant about seeing to it that children, coaches, everyone follow the rules, I think we are doing a real service for our young athletes.
You know, one other thing to on this topic, I mean, there's other stuff to talk about, but I want to just say I read it yet another story about how football helmet makers are trying to make even safer helmets now. What are your thoughts about that?
You know, that's a real fraught issue because there is so far not really good scientific evidence that helmets prevent concussions. They definitely prevent skull fractures.
Yeah.
They prevent all sorts of other injuries. But the extent to which any kind of helmet prevents a concussion is really unknown. That a concussion is when you basically your head goes one direction, your brain goes the other, and it bounces against the side of the skull. And so helmets are not tremendously helpful in preventing concussions.
We need seatbelts for the brains, right?
We do need seatbelts. And the way to do that is really to follow the rules, which means you make sure that if young children are doing any kind of tackling, that they're doing it in a way that protects the head. If they are heading a soccer ball, that they don't start before the age of at least 11. And if they are doing it, that they are doing it correctly. All those things are really important for protecting the brains of young children.
I just learned last week, I don't know how I missed this over the years, but that kids can do tackle football at pretty young ages, at like kind of little league football, if you will.
Yes, I'm not going to give my opinion about that.
I was just surprised.
I think actually there are fewer and fewer sort of Pop Warner leagues that do allow tackle football.
Okay.
At their really young ages. And there is evidence that tackling drills in children below the age of 12 can have lingering consequences in terms of mood, schoolwork, all sorts of things. So if my son, who never played football, had been that age, frankly, I would not have allowed him to take part in any drills that involve tackling. But that's every parent has to decide for themselves.
You know, when you talk about the laws in states that require you to take a kid off the field, you know, that kind of a thing, report a suspected concussion, that kind of thing. What are the, is there any teeth in those laws?
Well, we hope there is. There are not penalties per se. I mean, a coach is not going to be fined, as far as I know, in any state, if it doesn't happen. A parent could presumably report the coach. Mm-hmm. There could be various consequences, perhaps civil. Right now, there's not very much tooth in any of those laws. What they rely on are people's goodwill.
Okay.
And right now, I hope that means that parents will not ever feel like it's more important that their child stay in and try and get a college scholarship down the line.
Yeah.
Because particularly with repeated head trauma, there's no doubt at all that more than one concussion is just dramatically worse than a single concussion. So if your child has had one incident of a confirmed concussion, sit down with a neurologist and talk very honestly about what it means to continue with that kind of contact sport.
Gretchen Reynolds, thanks as always for joining us. I really appreciate your time.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Gretchen Reynolds, New York Times Well Blog columnist. Thanks for listening to Wellness Wednesday today on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.